by Rabbi David Kaplan. Rabbi Kaplan is originally from Chicago. He attended Northeastern University and received his rabbinical ordination in Jerusalem. He has lectured widely in Israel and America and is currently a senior lecturer at the main campus in Jerusalem.
And now we're going to get back to the philosophy. Right, we're going to get back into more hashkafa-oriented mitzvahs. 166 is the mitzvah of a woman who gives birth is in a state of ritual impurity. Now, basically, the law is anytime a woman has any type of bleeding whatsoever, any type of vaginal bleeding whatsoever, she's automatically ritually impure. Now, in the birth process, there's certainly an awful lot of blood, right? So, even theoretically, this law would apply even theoretically if there was no blood, right? But if she went in a normal birthing process, if there is blood, so a woman becomes, by Torah law, if a woman has a son, she is tameh, she's ritually impure for 7 days. She has a daughter, she's ritually impure for 14 days. Okay? Now, the mitzvah is officially the concept of her impurity. That's how it's described. Inyan, tumas, hayoledet. The concept of the woman who gives birth, the concept of her becoming ritually impure. Now, the idea is like this. First of all, the impurity in general, or the entire, what's the entire birthing process, where did that come from? The entire concept of a woman becoming, giving birth and having pain when she gives birth, where did that come from?
The original sin,
right? So there's a certain amount of atonement in this, according to the commentary, there's a certain amount of atonement contained in the entire process. You know that, Richard? That if it had not for the original sin, so a woman would not go the birth process. And when Chava had her first son, or had two sons, she had Cain and Hevel, right? She got pregnant and had the children in a day, right? That the entire process would take a day. There would be no such thing as it's called the pain of pregnancy, the difficulty of pregnancy, and the pain of childbirth. Pregnancy itself is very difficult. You will see, Bezras Hashem, when your wife gets pregnant, it's not just the difficulty of carrying. Imagine strap a small bowling ball to your stomach, right, and walk around with that all day, right? Imagine what that does to your back, if nothing else, right? Walking around with the weight on. Now, besides that, the woman's body goes through so many changes. She's constantly tired, right? Her appetite changes, heartburn phenomenon in pregnancy. Woman can get heartburn. A woman at night is very, very tired. It's difficult for her to concentrate. She loses her appetite. So many things that happen in pregnancy that it's all a result of that original sin. That's first of all. Second of all, then comes birth, right? Where the birth is excruciatingly painful. I remember I told you the first time we had our first child. So I had heard all the time about how painful it's supposed to be. You know, so you prepare for it. Some people do Lamaze together, some people do Lamaze by themselves, right? And you go, you read the books, and you figure out, and then finally she goes into labor, and you go driving down there, you know, remember, you're all set for it. Remember walking in the first time, and we got to the house, so they said, you know, let me show you the chamber, they had a word for, some fancy word for the room where she's going to give birth. Remember them as we're walking towards this room, all of a sudden we hear from down the hall a blood-curdling scream from down, like that. We're just frozen in our tracks. Oh, what is that? And the midwife is, you know, she didn't even bat an eye. Oh, I think it's a woman giving birth. Oh, wow. You know, it's something that I remember that moment because up until that point, you don't even realize. It actually struck me a little bit earlier because when we walked into the hospital, there was a young girl, an Arab actually, probably about 17, 18 years old, who was in what they call active labor, right? And I remember when we looked at her, and this girl did not look well, right? And she was in active labor. At that point, I was thinking, oh, you know, it could be. But when I heard that scream just took, you breathe, and all of a sudden everything goes flying out the window because you hear this scream, and so all of that is a punishment the original sin. So in the birth process, there's an atonement of sorts. So the commentaries say that when she has a daughter, so there's a double atonement. The ritual impurity is also part of that atonement, that you have to be ritually impure for a certain period of time. So if she has a daughter, so then you need a ritual impurity period both for her and for her daughter. Therefore, it's 14 days. And if she has a son, so it's a period of 7 days. Scott?
So let me just remind myself of ritual impurity means you can't physically hold your wife's hand for the next 14 days.
That's one, yes.
In this
particular, there's no contact allowed between the two of you. I mean, it goes further. In time to make some English, that means she's not allowed to eat the holy food, like truma or any of the parts of the sacrifice that women normally would be allowed to eat. She's not allowed to eat. She's got a stater. She's not allowed on the temple mount. Right? She's not allowed to go. So she is considered ritually impure. In practical terms, it means that the minute your wife begins active labor, you are not allowed to do anything even as slight as mopping her brow. You are not allowed to make any physical contact whatsoever. Once the cervix opens to a certain point, right? Once the cervix begins to open, at that point the husband is not allowed to touch his wife at all. Right? Obviously, if she needs help getting out to the ambulance, right, or being driven to the hospital, that you could. You don't have to touch her through a handkerchief. Right? You can balance her if you need to, but you cannot touch her to comfort her once she's in that. If she is theoretically at a point where she's on the verge of chas v'shalom, if her husband doesn't mop her brow, she'll die, then you could, right? But under most circumstances, you know, especially a frum woman who's conditioned for this, right? So it doesn't. And I can tell you that one of the last things women want is their husband to be around. Very often women don't want the husband around when they're getting birth.
You're allowed to be around?
You're allowed to be around. You're not allowed to watch the process actively, but you could be in the room.
You can watch from the right end. You can stand next to her head.
You cannot actively watch the birth. You are allowed in the room, but one of the things that it's interesting because in a woman's makeup, especially if she has a labor coach, if she's only with the husband, she needs the husband for moral support. But if she has a labor coach, a woman to help her with the breathing, which is essential in giving birth. Then very often they don't want the husband around. The wife will get irritated. The husband's presence will irritate her, and the part of that is psychologically because up until this point it's all been theory, right? Now in active labor, right, he is the one person in that room. When the labor coach says to her, it's okay, right? Then the husband says, yeah, honey, it's okay. Shut up. What do you know? Right? How can you possibly know it's okay? You're a man. You can't possibly be involved. We're going to get to that. What you're saying, we're going to get to that in a second. But psychologically, it's like, this guy is irritating me. You can't possibly. It's like when you empathize, one of the most irritating things is when let's say you flunk a test in school. Right? So when your buddy who usually flunks tests starts empathizing, he says, listen, don't worry, it's not so bad. Your parents won't be too upset. You know, they'll ground you for a couple of years. But, yeah, that comforting your life. When the guy who's a straight-A student comes over and says to you, you know, it's okay, don't worry about it. Get out of here. Make me sick, people like you. What do you know about what I'm going through? So to a certain extent, that's what that psychologically, she is interested in seeing you. Right? And the husband should not take offense when that happens. When the wife says to him, get out, I was only too pleased, right? At the point, we had even decided beforehand that she said to me, it could be that if I'm in a lot of pain, I'm not going to want you in the room. I'm just like, I'm perfectly, And then she would just start going into, because the contractions come every few minutes, and then she started, then it's intense pain. At that point, she would just go like that, and I'd be out, the labor coach is with her, and I just want to be as far away. And I remember because the doctor said to me, do you want to come into the room? And no, not at all. I have no interest in being there whatsoever, right? It's so to each his own. But so that's one of them. Now the other idea is like this. This is Rabbi Hirsch. You've heard of Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch? Rabbi Hirsch was the leader of German Jewry. He was born in 1808, he died in 1888. He was the leader of German Jewry, and he was one of the forefront of the fight against the Enlightenment and Reform. Right, he was practically single-handedly trying to maintain the Orthodox viewpoint against the onslaught of Reform in Germany, which is where that was the cradle of Reform Judaism, and he was fighting against it. So one of the things he did, he wrote a very interesting commentary on the Torah, part of which was with this in mind, to appeal to the intellectuals of the people who are being swept away by the reform, to show them the logic and how much sense the Torah makes. So he tries to explain, this is obviously a sore spot, why should a woman be double impure twice as long for a daughter as she is for a son? So Rebbe Hirsch says that... Yes, when a woman gives birth, so if she has a son, she's impure for 7 days. If she has a daughter, she's impure for 14 days.
After she gives birth.
So Rebbe Hirsch says that the idea is that the role model, and this is also just a fact, not just in Torah life, this is a fact that all through the world, that the role model for a son is the father, and the role model for the daughter is the mother. It's just the way things work. And therefore, obviously there's crossover, right? Obviously there's influence, but the, you know, you're loyal, the one in your corner, right? You're loyal, the one you can rely on is the son-father, daughter-mother relationship. And therefore, the mother being the role model for the daughter is a double period of impurity to help her realize the importance of training her daughter in this area, in the area of ritual purity and impurity. That means all of the education for the daughter comes from the mother. In traditional society, that's the way it works. And therefore, it's an emphasis for the mother on how to teach how much important it is, because the purity of the Jewish home, that's the cornerstone of the success of the Jewish home, is its family purity and all the laws of ritual impurity. Yeah.
When you say impurity, can't she go to the mikvah
She could go to the mikvah, but she can't. You can. A woman cannot go to the mikvah. Sometimes there's a certain type of impurity, which is a minimum. Let's say a woman menstruates. At the point that a woman menstruates, it's a minimum 5 days of ritual impurity. And after those 5 days of ritual impurity, she then has to count 7 days where there's no blood at all. So you're talking about a minimum, if the minute a woman menstruates, there's a minimum 12 days that she can't go to the, until she can go to the mikvah, a minimum of 12 days. And if her period takes a little longer, then it can be 13, 14, or 15 days, right, depending on how long her period lasts. Right? So that's so you can't just go to the mikvah, right? The mikvah has to be with a certain amount of, there's a certain amount of days between the time that she becomes impure and the time she purifies herself.
So after those 7 days she goes to the mikvah, or after those 14 days she goes to the mikvah?
She could, and this is all Torah law. By rabbinic law, there are a few added days. It gets a little more complicated, right? But by Torah law, yes.
Well, what's more complicated?
All sorts of. There's still bleeding. According to us, we hold down that any type of bleeding whatsoever is problematic. You get into all sorts of technical problems afterwards, right? But you'll learn that. You'll learn when you get married. You have to know those halachas. So you learn all the detail. I don't even remember myself from after each birth, you have to review the halachas to find out, you know, what's up, right? Because it's a whole new set of laws they're playing by. Okay. 167 is a technical halacha about that a certain, is the only technical one we're going to do today, somebody who is impure is not allowed to eat from the kodshim. The kodshim means the holy stuff. Right? Somebody who's ritually impure cannot allow, whether it's korbanos or whether it's truma, somebody who is ritually impure is not allowed to eat from the kodshim. Now, yeah, probably. A lot of the laws in the Torah are repeated in various, sometimes positive and negative, and sometimes certain aspects of them are repeated.
Can you repeat that word from the what?
Kodshim. The kodshim. Kuf dalet shin yud mem sofis. The kodshim, the holy. The holy
times food. Of the Beis Hamikdash.
Right. Nowadays we don't have kodshim. Nowadays we don't eat the kodshim because we are all considered ritually impure with no chance of purifying ourselves. Now 168, Elan had actually touched upon this. This is very interesting.
Can I ask you a question? Yes. If we're all ritually impure, then why does the woman need to go to a mikvah? Because if you're ritually impure anyway, then as soon as she comes to the mikvah, she's still going to be ritually impure, and you're ritually impure anyway.
Very good.
Why can't she touch you?
Very good. A very good question, and the answer is that there are different levels of ritual impurity. If a woman comes into contact with a dead body, so she's off limits for certain things. She's not off limits to her husband. Right? She's ritually impure. She can't walk into the temple, right, until she's sprinkled with the ashes of the red cow. She's not ritually impure to her husband. The only thing that keeps her off limits to her husband is if she's had a flow of blood. Right? So she could go to mikvah. A mikvah is sufficient to remove that minor impurity of being anita. Right? It's not sufficient to remove the major impurity of having come into contact with a dead body. Okay. 168, Elan had actually touched on this, is the mitzvah
that a woman who gives birth, who has given birth, after her days, she counts a certain amount of days, and at the end of this point, she has to bring two korbans. At the end of the point, right, she's impure for a certain amount of time, and then she goes through a certain period where she counts a certain amount of days, and then she has to bring two korbans. Now, what do you generally associate a korban with?
Sin.
What's that?
Sin.
So what's the, isn't it a little bit bizarre that a woman who's given birth has to bring a korban? Why would, Oh, so one of the ideas is, a korban todah, right? It's a Thanksgiving offering, right? What's she thanking Hashem for?
For being alive. Yeah.
Right? It's, she's thanking Hashem for having had a safe, for having had a safe delivery, right? That just the fact that she's had a safe delivery is something to thank Hashem for. What else is it? There is an atonement dimension. What's the atonement dimension here?
Well, cursing the husband when she's giving birth.
Very close. Very close. Commentaries say that a woman, when she gives birth, at a minimum, if she doesn't say it verbally, she at least thinks to herself, she vows to herself silently that she is never again going to end up like this. Right? She vows, whether she says the words or she thinks the words, at a certain point she accepts on herself, I am never going to do whatever it is that caused me to end up in this situation.
Does she want her husband do it, or that she won't?
I don't care how you word it, that she is not going to get pregnant again. Right? She vows she is going to stay distant from her husband. Right? Because it's that man who's gotten her into this much pain. Right? And that vow, which she obviously does not mean, right? That vow, however, was there, and therefore that vow, whether verbal or thought, needs an atonement. And therefore the atonement, is she brings the korban as an atonement for this this vow. Now, what's interesting, and here is where we're going to not have a fight, because we're not going to go into it too much, but this is also a sociological fact. Why is it she brings the korbanos after she's had a son sooner than after she had? When she's had a son, she brings these sacrifices after 40 days. When she's had a daughter, she brings these sacrifices after 80 days. Why? Why, when it comes to a son?
Because it's sex religion.
Because why?
It's a sex religion.
Besides, what about it? Right? So there's a very interesting idea. There's also, and I can tell you from experience, it's 100% true. The same woman who made a vow that she'll never be with her husband again, if she's had a son, she's more easily appeased than if she's had a daughter. Do you know why?
It pleases the husband
more when he has a son. That's a fact. Right? No matter what you're thinking right now, right? Deep down inside, when your wife gets pregnant, and people are going to say, that's exactly right, especially the first one. Somebody's going to say to you, when your wife is pregnant, what do you want? And you're going to say, it doesn't matter as long as it's healthy. And then when your wife is not listening, say, and there's a bris. Right? that's what you're going to say, right? That means, psychologically, and it's not unique to the Jewish world. It works all over the world. Yeah, your big burly truck driver wants to go into the tavern at night. And get the, you know, he comes in, he goes, I had a boy. It's not the same going, I had a girl, and she's a bruiser too. And it's not the same as walking in there and slapping the backs when you finally had a boy, right? Why is that? First of all, you should know, and this is unbelievable, even in a frum community, you see women on the street, women are pregnant, and you know that they're bound to pop one of these days, right? And the next thing, you don't hear anything, right? If you don't hear anything, you could bet all your money was a girl. Right? If it's a boy, you hear about it right away. And if it's a girl, you just don't seem to know. Why? First of all, if it's a boy, you hear about it because there's a celebration. But this is not unique. That's why I say it's not unique to the Torah community. This is in the world in general. There's a boy is born, it's an event. If Prince Charles had a girl, the first one, there's a big fuss because he had a boy. Right? What if it would have been a girl? Right? Not the same type of fuss. It's just the way, it's innate in human nature. Therefore, the woman is more readily appeased when it comes to having a boy, then when she has a boy and they have a girl. Remember, in Torah society, it's because there's a bigger fuss made in the celebrations. You have a shalom zachar, and then you have a bris. right?
You have two,
exactly. You have two ceremonies, right? A Shal Zachar is the first Friday night that the boy is alive. You have a party, right? So you have more, there's more external celebration. For the girl, you make a kiddush and shul. Right? You make a kiddush and shul. And even that's not required by halacha, it's a custom, right? But don't worry. The girl gets it back when she's 18 years old, and then you got to dish out for her. You got to shell out for her wedding. Right, that's when you know, the great equalizer, 18 years later. He actually said, Elon, they went to the stipler, a man went to the stipler. I don't remember, I told you about the stipler that rabbi people used to go to for brachas. A man went to the stipler, and he said to the stipler, he's got a daughter, she's already getting older, she's already close to 20. That would be the reaction, right? She's actually getting a little older, she's in her late 20s. Right, and he can't find her a shidduch. Right, he's having trouble finding a suitable match for his daughter. And it's, you know, in Torah society, Torah circles, the girl's in her late 20s. That's already getting out. Right, and you know, he said, well, how come I can't find her? So the stipler said to him, when she was born, did you make a kiddush to celebrate? So the man said, as a matter of fact, I didn't. So the stipler said, you know, the kiddush. People come. What do people say to you when you make a kiddush when you have a daughter? People give you a bracha. There's a standard bracha. You should raise her the Torah, chuppah, and ma'asim tovim. Right? She should follow the way of Torah. She should go to the chuppah, and she should perform good deeds. Right? He said to the man, you had a daughter. You never got all these brachas at the kiddush. Right? How can you possibly expect to marry up? You never received the brachas that your daughter should get married. Go home and make a kiddush. The man went home, made a kiddush for her daughter, and shortly afterwards, she got, you know, I mean, it sounds a little strange, right? You know, the Schwartzes invite everybody, the congregation, Zelda, you know, 27 years, right? The man made a kiddush, right? And people gave him the bracha, and then shortly afterwards, she was a kiddush. Right, so that's the idea.
What was the first reason against her? The second reason was vowing to herself she'd never have. What was the first reason for bringing the korban?
To thank God. To thank God for having spared her life. As I can tell you, it doesn't matter if it's secular Jews, it doesn't matter if it's Torah Jews. I have four kids, two are boys and two are girls. And I've seen it over and over and over, that when they're real small, right, and somebody, you know, you're waiting in the doctor's office, you're waiting somewhere in the supermarket, and somebody looks at the baby and says, is it a boy or a girl? I say, it's a boy. A boy! Oh, coochie, coochie, coochie. And they start playing with you, right? And you say to them, say, a girl? Hello, sweetie. No big deal. And you can ask, if you don't believe me, you can ask my wife. It's something, huh? It's simply human nature. It's human nature. That's the way it is. It's got nothing to do with Torah nature. Huh? It has nothing to do with Torah.
I'd love to see you giving this shit to a woman.
Huh? The women are, you should know, the women are worse than the men. The women are worse than the men.
What do you mean worse?
Worse in that the fuss they make when it's a boy over a girl, when they hear the news that somebody had a boy versus a girl, the fuss, the women are more pronounced in their emphasis on the men than the girls are.
No, but I mean, you have to give the shit inside the vibe to a whole bunch of female
I wouldn't have. You just tell them that they're on a higher spiritual level, and then you tell them the facts. Right? Yeah. First give them a compliment, then just tell them the facts the way they are. Right? And I haven't listened to you. Once you tell them you're on a higher spiritual level, I think that's a good thing. You made their day. Okay, let's go on. Now, the next one is very fascinating. The mitzvah of the mitzvah is 169, and it's called, the name of the mitzvah is the mitzvah of the concept of tzaraas. Now, tzaraas.
What
it sounds like. Tzaraas, which we translate as leprosy. Now, that is... The only reason we translate leprosy is for lack of a different word.
This is the commitment.
The concept, no, not to get leprosy, but the concept of leprosy, because there are all sorts of laws that go with it. Now, first of all, there are three forms of leprosy. Right? Torah leprosy is a non-physiological type of leprosy. It manifests itself physiologically. That means there are external physiological signs on the body. Who's the most famous person that got leprosy in the Torah? They got tzaraas. Miriam. Right? Moshe's sister Miriam had saras, and the entire Jewish people waited for her. Right? For 7 days she was outside the camp. Right?
So you said the Torah of the Negros is not physical.
It's a it manifests itself physically, but it is a supernatural type of leprosy. That means it's not medically treated. It's not treated medically the way you would treat leprosy nowadays. And again, as I say, the word leprosy is because of a lack of a different way of translating saras. The most accurate translation of saras is saras.
You're saying we can still get it these days?
I'm sorry?
You're saying we can still get this?
No. So Torah saras we do not get nowadays. Torah saras is a sign of divine, what you call hashkacha pratis, God's divine, what do you call hashkacha pratis? Individual divine providence, divine providence on an individual level where you see clearly that God is interacting with this world. Now, what did you get? First of all, how did saras come? So there are three ways that saras could manifest itself. There could be saras on the house. You get it on a house.
Could it be the house or leaves?
The house what?
What is it, fungus in the house?
It looks like, yes, exactly. You see some type of fungus. And you have to go to the Kohen and you tell the Kohen, hey, I see something on the walls of my house over here. And the Kohen comes to your house and he examines it. And if it is not saras, he tells you it's not saras. If it is saras, then there are certain procedures you have to go through. And if it's not sure, then you have to leave it and see if it spreads or not. And then the Kohen comes back in a week and he takes a look at it to see what happens. If it is saras, eventually what they have to do is they have to take out those bricks. They have to remove those bricks from the house. And eventually, if it spreads all over the house, they may have to trash the entire house. They have to destroy the
house. You have to take everything out of the house.
I'm sorry, you have to take everything out. We'll get to the house. I'm just giving you an overview of the entire house.
Torah Saras?
Torah Saras. I'm talking about Torah Saras. That means the guy is sitting in his house. The guy's in his house and says, hey, Edna, I see some mold up there on the wall. Ooh, that looks bad, right? Better go to the Kohen, right? That's one type of Saras. There's another type of Saras, which is Saras that come on the clothing. Right? Person's got clothing and all of a sudden his clothing has developed leprosy. Imagine, right? What's the entire purpose of these? The entire purpose is it's a warning for a person. Saras is a warning. You better start doing tshuva. Right? That's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu first brings it on external things. The house, his clothing, that's a warning. You better start doing tshuva before it hits your body. Now, the last type of saras, probably the most common type, is where the saras directly affects the body. And we know the most common cause for this, when people think of saras, people think of lashon hara, right? For improper gossip, for improper speech, that's why the saras comes. So what happens? A guy has some type of outbreak, right, on his body. It can be anywhere on his body, and he sees either a discoloration, there are various forms of saras. Now, what he's got to do is, he's got to go to the Kohen, and the Kohen takes a look at him. If this man has saras, he is at a very high level of ritual impurity, and he must be put outside of the camp. Right? He's all by himself outside of the camp, and no one is allowed within 4 amos of him. Right? Anybody who comes near him, he has to yell out, "Tame, tame, I am impure." He has to let people know, "I am impure, stay away from me." Now, the Bible critics, I guess it's the Bible critics, but many people, the skeptics, who deny any type of divine providence, any type of supernatural, they speak of the saras in the Torah as regular leprosy, right? That we're making up some story about having this divine providence and some type of divine leprosy, right? Rabbi Hirsch lists about 10 reasons, proving 10 things, factors, and he proves that this is not regular leprosy. Right? It's very interesting. First of all, if a person had suspected regular leprosy, who would you call to examine it?
A doctor.
Call a doctor. By Torah law, you call the Kohen. The Kohen who is not trained medically, to the contrary, the Kohen, even nowadays, you know, a Kohen is not allowed to be a doctor? I did not say that correctly. A Kohen is not allowed to study medicine to become a doctor. Right. If a Kohen is a Baal, studied medicine and become a Baal Tshuva, he can remain as a doctor. A Kohen nowadays cannot become a doctor because a doctor has to work on cadavers in order to get through medical school, and a Kohen is not allowed to come into contact with the dead bodies. Right? Therefore, a Kohen nowadays is the last candidate who is going to become a doctor. right? In Torah society, you invited in the Kohen, and the Kohen had to examine in order to check for the leprosy. That's first of all. Second of all, if a person had the leprosy, let's say a person had was a little heavy, right? There are certain fleshy folds in the body. The Kohen does not inspect inside any folds on the body. Right? If it's a contagious type of leprosy, that would be ridiculous, right? Because why should you inspect the fold? So that's another reason. Ilan had mentioned, if it's a house that's being examined, so first thing they did is they removed all the items from the house before the Kohen would perform the examination. Now, why do you think they did that? Because if the Kohen does the examination and he says the house is impure, so then what happens? Everything in the house becomes impure. So what did we want to do? We want to give the people...
Once he says it, that's it.
Once he says it, that's it. That's why... So what do we want to do? We want to give the person as good a chance as possible, right? First, get everything out of the house. Now the Kohen will come and he'll decide whether it's ritually impure or not. Well, that would be ridiculous if it's a contagious disease. To the contrary, you keep everything in the house and you quarantine it off. You don't remove everything from the house.
Please turn the tape to the other side.